Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting on the issues that make a difference for progressive minds. Today, the latest on health and healing. Walnuts rank as the top of all the nuts, providing the highest level of quality antioxidants. Then we have how broccoli cuts prostate cancer risk, and how tart cherry juice is a natural cure for insomnia. And the risk doubles for obese men for death. Grapefruit compound can treat diabetes and lower cholesterol. Yes. And cherries may help you reduce pain. And a lot more on health and healing. Then we're going to take a look at a lot of other issues, including why public schools outperform private schools. But hold on, we've been told just the opposite. Well, we were not told the truth. We'll give you the latest on that with a special report from Jeffrey Aaron Schneider from Boston Review. Also, Pillaging the World, the History and Politics of the International Monetary Fund by Ernst Wolf, Global Research. And another ineffective and toxic flu drug approved by the FDA by Dr. Brownstein. So as you see, we have a lot to share on a lot of different issues, including one on the environment, the Fukushima Endgame, Radioactive Contamination of the Pacific Ocean by Professor Michael Jofskadowski. So let's begin. We all should be consuming raw organic nuts on a regular basis, preferably daily. Don't worry about the calories. Generally, if you have a reasonable amount, like a handful of nuts, that's about 3 ounces, not a whole lot. But the nutrients in it are very important for us. Now, they took an analysis of all the different nuts and found that the walnut had the highest level of antioxidants of any nut species. It's rich in vitamins, minerals, and fiber, and it has a very good balance of polyunsaturated and monounsaturated fats that lowered the deadly artery-clogging small-density oxidative LDL cholesterol, the bad cholesterol. So if you add just a handful of walnuts each day, you're able to help ward off cardiovascular disease and even cancer. A Dr. Joseph Vinson performed the analysis. It showed walnuts provide more antioxidants to the body than any other nuts, including almonds, pistachios, pecans, so it's a good deal. And people have stayed away from nuts, but you don't want the dry roasted, and you don't want them deep fried, which is the way most of the commercial nuts are made. Broccoli is just a superstar when it comes to being a healthy food. Now, broccoli sprouts are also good. Now, some researchers have found once again that sulforaphane, which is a sulfur compound, it's a chemical in broccoli, interacts with cells lacking a gene called PTEN to reduce the chance of prostate cancer developing. Richard Mithen from the Institute for Food Research worked with a team of researchers at the Norwich Research Park in the United Kingdom. They did these experiments in human prostate tissue. And they found that the sulforaphane from broccoli helps as an anti-cancer nutrient. Quote, PTEN, a tumor suppressor gene, the deletion or inactivation of which can initiate prostate carcinogenesis and enhance the probability of cancer progression. We've shown here that sulforaphane has different effects depending upon whether the PTEN gene is present. So in lay language, they found that the sulforaphane is very good for helping prevent prostate cancer. So have your broccoli. And I just had some broccoli last night, and very easy to make. In fact, I was making myself some corn on the cob. And generally, you got to eat the corn on the cob the day you get it, because otherwise, this time of year, it turns pitted and hence no longer sweet and no longer fresh. So you bring your water up to a boil, and then you turn it off, and then let the corn heat itself so you're not overcooking it. At the same time, you dip your broccoli, always wash your broccoli with some veggie wash, and then you get rid of any surface grime, any molds, anything that might have been in the field that's on the broccoli. So then you take your whole crown, cut off the stem. Stems are very good, by the way, for dogs to chew on. And birds like them too. Anyhow, you put that into the hot water and you leave it in there for about 3 minutes and you take it out and then you put it on a dish. Now, the nice part about the broccoli is put lemon juice, fresh lemon juice, lots of it, on the crown of broccoli. Then put some extra virgin organic olive oil on, then some Himalayan sea salt, and then eat that. It is so delicious, but it also is loaded with nutrients. And so that's one of the ways we can help prevent prostate cancer. The article, by the way, was published in the peer-reviewed journal Molecular Cancer. Now, cherries are good, but the tart cherry is the best. There are so many articles on the tart cherry. Now, most people don't eat tart cherries because they don't taste sweet. And the only time you see tart cherries in health food stores is when they're dried, and they generally are covered in sugar. But getting tart cherries into your body is important. University of Pennsylvania and the University of Rochester and the VA Center for Research conducted a pilot program on the sleep habits of older adults. When they gave the older adults 8 ounces of tart cherry juice beverage in the morning and in the evening for 2 weeks, and then a comparable juice drink with no tart cherry juice for another 2 drink period, there was, quote, significant reduction in reported insomnia severity, and the people kept sleep longer. Now, why? Because what they found was that natural benefits of tart cherries were high in melatonin. Now, we know that melatonin is what our pineal gland secretes at night, and that helps us sleep. So that's important. So take some tart cherry juice at night, and also it turns off pain. It turns off inflammation in the brain. That can help people with dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, and multiple sclerosis. It turns off pain in your joints, arthritis, in your muscles, fibromyalgia. It turns off inflammation in your intestine, diverticulitis, spastic colon, GERD, ulcers. So it's just good at all levels. So make sure you're getting your tart cherry. And that was published in the Journal of Medicinal Food. I've said this so many times, and I know that the people in this audience understand it, but probably the average person does not. Being overweight is never a good thing. I can't tell you how many former football players who were massive on the field, 300, 350 pounds, they were like refrigerators moving, and then they retire, and then they lose their muscle, and they develop all forms of disease. Trying to get the fat percentage down in a man to about, I believe, the healthy issue should be is about 14% maximum, ideally around 10% body fat. The average man's closer to 30. The average woman's over 30. It was 26 and 24, but that's gone up. Here's the bottom line. If you're overweight, if you're obese, you're going to die sooner. This is the latest study on this, done at the Institute of Preventive Medicine, Copenhagen University Hospital, Institute of Biomedical Sciences in the University of Copenhagen. It says the following, quote, obese men face double the risk of dying prematurely. Danish researchers tracked more than 5,000 military conscripts starting at the age of 20 up to the age of 80. They found that at any given age, an obese man was twice as likely to die than one who was not obese, and that obesity at the age of 20 had a constant effect on death up to 60 years later. Quote, as the obesity epidemic is still progressing rapidly, especially among children and adolescents, it's important to find out if obesity in early adulthood has lifetime mortality effects. It does. So by having an overweight or obese child, you put them at risk of dying much earlier. And this was a large study, and it went on a long period of time. So you've got to get your, what is called BMI, your body mass index, get it down. Stop eating the empty calories and start exercising, and that'll make a big difference, and that could help save your life. Because a lot of guys are thinking, okay, well, I'm all right, and then they're not, because one day they had their stroke or heart attack. Now, here's good news for those of you who are taking your antioxidants on a daily basis. This is from the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestion and Kidney Disease. They found that a diet loaded with antioxidant-rich foods improves insulin resistance. Now, what kind of foods are we talking about? We're talking about beans. Right up top of the list are your beans, because they help stabilize your blood sugar. Nuts, sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, chia seeds, starchy vegetables. They're rich in antioxidants, and they improve insulin resistance. So pre-diabetics, diabetics, overweight people, a healthy vegan diet. And a grapefruit compound could treat diabetes, lower cholesterol, and help you with dieting. That's the latest. And what it is this. The big pharma for a long time has been looking for the magic drug that could target a group of nuclear receptor proteins in the body known as PPAR. And the reason that PPAR regulate the expression of genes that are involved in fat and carbohydrate metabolism, among other things. So quite simply, if you could regulate them, you could help prevent diabetes, you could help lower a person's cholesterol, you could help them from gaining a lot of weight. This peroxisome proliferator activated receptors can be dealt with in another way without an expensive toxic drug. Grapefruit. That's right. Grapefruit has the ability to help treat diabetes naturally, and it also helps with overweight. There was research by scientists at Hebrews University of Jerusalem and Massachusetts General Hospital had discovered that an antioxidant derived from the bitter flavor of grapefruits and other citrus fruits triggers the liver to break down fat. And this is naringin, naringin. That is the antioxidant. So that when you have the bitter is what's actually helping you. So while the function of the pancreas is important to diabetes, the liver is the main organ responsible for the regulation of carbohydrates and blood levels of fat. So how could you do this? Let's just say that you really weren't paying attention. You ate out. You ate not necessarily the right foods. Go home and have yourself a glass of grapefruit juice. That will help. All right? But better still, have yourself a glass of grapefruit juice and don't eat bad foods. There's also an increased sensitivity to insulin when you have grapefruits. That is good. And that was published in PLOS ONE, the scientific journal. So that's the latest on the issues that make a difference. except for one on resveratrol. Now, resveratrol, of course, you find in grapes, and grapes are extremely important. I believe that the grape is one of nature's 10 most perfect foods. The grape skin, the grape seed, contains most of the benefit, and then the whole grape, and you're getting a lot of good antioxidant activity. Well, this is from the peer-reviewed journal Nutrition, Metabolism, and Cardiovascular Disease. Quote, resveratrol supplements could improve heart health. In lay language, if you have your resveratrol each day, it can improve your vascular function and lead to improved cardiovascular health. Quote, oral resveratrol supplementation elicited an acute dose-related improvement in endothelium-dependent vasodilation, as demonstrated by significant increase in FMD at each dose relative to a placebo, end quote. And that was from a Dr. Narelle Berry at the University of South Australia. We've talked many times about how there is a coating to all your veins and capillaries in the body. It's called the endothelium. And when you're taking in any food that's highly acidic, that is inflammatory, you're going to damage it. The damage causes lesions, and that causes buildup, a plaque, that reduces the flow of blood and nutrients and oxygen through the cells. So as a result, you end up with nutrient insufficiency, oxygen insufficiency, and circulatory insufficiency. You can see it in purple little veins in a person's ankles and feet, varicosities, and blockages of the carotid artery. By the time you notice all this, you're way, way into that disease process. So when we have ourselves some grape juice or grapes or anything made from that or resveratrol, you're helping to reverse that. Now, taking that with other polyphenols and isoflavones, that's how we clean up our arteries. Remember, it is the cardiovascular benefits of resveratrol. It's a polyphenol, and it suppresses platelet aggregation. That means that you're less likely to have a clump, which is going to cause a blockage and a stroke or heart attack. Big deal. Big deal. Also, you want to make sure that a mechanism behind blood vessel endothelial dysfunction is suggested to involve the impaired release of nitric oxide, causing blood vessels to constrict. You want just the opposite. You want blood vessels to dilate. You want to maximize blood going through your arteries and your veins. Well, increased resveratrol increases nitric oxide, and that can help men. Men, that can help you get an erection. How about that? And women, it also helps put more blood into the vagina. And for a lot of women over the age of 45, you're suffering from vaginal dryness, something that people don't talk about in our society. I don't know why. Because ask a woman who tries to have intimate relationships with her partner, and suddenly she's got chafing, bleeding, infection, pain, and a whole important part of her life is no longer available. So this way, by having grapes and resveratrol and the other antioxidants and isoflavones, and men, same with you, you can now have something that can challenge erectile dysfunction because it's that nitric oxide that you need to get the blood vessels open, to get blood engorging. And also, certain B vitamins, folic acid, B6 and B12, control one of the silent killers in our society. It's called homocysteine. When your homocysteine levels are elevated, you're going to have a faster shrinkage of the brain. You're going to have more Alzheimer's, stroke, heart attack, and cancer. So it doesn't take a lot in order to bring your homocysteine levels down. Trimethylglycine will do it at about 1,000 milligrams. 50 to 100 milligrams of B6, 1 microgram of folic acid, 1 microgram of B12, and you shouldn't have that problem. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health and healing. Now from our environmental segment. This is from Professor Michael Chofskadosky of the Global Research, and it's an article that I posted called The Fukushima Endgame, the Radioactive Contamination of the Pacific. It's short, but I thought it was important. And I won't read all of it because you can read it by going to the website and reading it. And by the way, I won't have a final figure till later this week, but I believe that we have passed 300 million visits and reads in the last 12 months. So clearly a lot of people are realizing the importance of articles that are not selected based upon their politic, but rather upon the truth. And that's why people from all walks of life, all religions, all backgrounds are using the material. And starting in another couple weeks, we're also going to be having a library for progressive documentaries. Our goal is to have more than 1,000 documentaries available for you this year for you to watch on any topic. And these are progressive documentaries. So this is something new and exciting. And our goal is to have 1 billion, with a B, billion, visits in the next 12 months. We believe we can do it, because the public is turning so far away from Fox and MSNBC and Huffington Post and all these other places that are so concerned about their ideology. And we don't. We don't have an ideology. Just find the truth and share it. This is one of those articles. Quote, nuclear radiation resulting from the March 2011 Fukushima disaster, which threatened life on the planet Earth, is not front page news in comparison to the most insignificant issues of public concern, including the local level of crime scene or the tabloid gossip reports on Hollywood celebrities. The shaky political consensus both in Japan, the United States, and Western Europe is that the crisis at Fukushima has been contained. The truth is otherwise. Known and documented, the ongoing dumping of highly radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean constitutes a potential trigger to a process of global radioactive contamination. This water contains plutonium-239, and its release into the ocean has both local as well as global repercussions. A microgram of plutonium, if inhaled, according to Dr. Helen Caldicott, can cause death. Certain isotopes of radioactive plutonium are known to cause the deadliest poisons to the face of the Earth. A mere microgram, a speck of darkness on a pinhead, a plutonium-239, if inhaled, will cause death. And radioactive plutonium can be harmful, causing leukemia and bone cancers. Quote, in the days following the 2011 earthquake and nuclear power plant explosions, seawater meant to cool the nuclear power plants instead carried radioactive elements back to the Pacific Ocean. Radioactive plutonium was one of the elements streamed back to sea. It would appear that the radioactive water was also penetrating parts of the Japanese coastline. Environmental testing of shoreline around the nuclear plant, as well as fish, especially tuna, showed negligible amounts of plutonium in the seawater. The plutonium, from what little is reported, sank in the sediment off the Japanese coast. A recent report suggests that the Japanese government is intent on releasing the remaining radioactive water into the ocean. The proposed solution becomes the cause of radioactive contamination of both the Japanese coastline as well as the Pacific Ocean, extending to the coastline of North America. While the chairman of the Nuclear Radiation Authority recognized that the water in the tanks is heavily tainted, a decision has nonetheless been taken to empty the tanks and dump all the water into the Pacific Ocean. The head of Japan's nuclear watchdog agency said contaminated water stored at the crippled Fukushima No. 1 nuclear power plant should be released into the ocean to ensure safe decommissioning of the reactors. The chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Authority made the comment just last week after visiting the facility to observe progress in dismantling the 6 reactors. The site was severely damaged by the tsunami. Quote, I was overwhelmed by the sheer number of tanks holding water tainted with radioactive substances. We have to dispose of that water. Yeah, by the way, we're talking about thousands of tanks, and they're leaking. With regard to expected protests by local fishermen over the discharge, he said, we also have to obtain the consent of local residents to carry out the work so we can somehow mitigate the increase in tainted water. And it goes on. Well, so they're going to release all that into the ocean. And remember, this does not go away, ever. This will be here, much of this plutonium will be here for thousands of years. Some elements, like iodine-131, which is a fission product, and 235 emits beta and gamma radiation, and that will not last forever. And cesium-137, that won't last forever. But you're talking about plutonium? Yeah, that lasts a long time. So just imagine the ocean is not stagnant, it's not static, it has waves, it moves. Seaweed is eaten by smaller fish, eaten by larger fish, eaten by tuna, swordfish, and they swim. They have migratory patterns. Salmon also. So there is no such thing as eliminating pollution by dilution. Yeah, the ocean is large, but all it takes is a speck of radiation in your body. It's like having a little X-ray machine that just goes off every millisecond for the rest of your life. You don't want that. Shouldn't have it. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to, in a few moments, we're going to hear a report from a person that many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with, E.D. Wilson. He's 85 years of age. He is one of the great minds in understanding species, how many species we have left on the planet, how they're interrelated, how we should be understanding that relationship, and how we should do something to prevent their destruction. He gives some bad news, and he gives some good news. We'll have that in a few moments. But now I just want to begin to give you some information on this whole myth that the private schools are graduating the best students, who are getting the best grades, who have the best teachers, and that's why they're favored. It's simply not true. And I'm posting Jeffrey Aaron Snyder's Boston Review article on this, entitled Why Public Schools Outperform Private Schools. Let me share a little bit of this now. And again, if you're interested in the whole piece, you should read it in its entirety. Quote, would it surprise you to learn that students attending a traditional district-run public schools outperform their peers in charter and private schools? This is the bold claim at the heart of Christopher and Sarah Lubinsky's new book, The Public School Advantage. The author's extensive analysis of two large-scale, nationally representative data sets produced results that run counter to common wisdom and research consensus. Conventional wisdom, spread by leading educational reformers and politicians of all stripes and the editorial pages of major newspapers, assumes that charters are academically superior. And for 25 years, researchers have largely agreed that private school students, too, fare better academically than do public school counterparts. This finding even has a name. It's called the private school effect. Private school students do, in fact, score better on tests, but the authors wanted to figure out if this advantage is a genuine marker of superior education in private schools or simply an artifact of the more privileged backgrounds of the students who attended them. To answer these questions, the Lubinskys decided to analyze math achievement scores. Math, they explained, is an especially good indicator of school effectiveness because it is a subject, quote, learned primarily in school as compared with other subjects such as reading, which tend to be more heavily influenced by students' experiences at home. The authors examined two main data sets, a longitudinal study, more than 20,000 students who started kindergarten in the fall of 1998, and the 2003 National Assessment of Education Progress, which served more than 300,000 fourth-eighth graders. Now, using sophisticated analytical tools with names that only a statistician could love, hierarchical linear modeling, multivariate regression, the authors conclude that the private school effect is a myth. After accounting for the demographic differences among different school sector populations, traditional public school students perform just as well in math as did their private school peers. In grade 4, public school students actually outpaced their demographically similar peers in private schools. Furthermore, the Lebenskys discovered that even though private school children arrive in kindergarten a little more academically prepared than their public school peers, public school students make up the difference over the course of elementary school. Call it the public school effect. Echoing the results of other major research studies, the report states that traditional public schools also hold a slight edge over charters, which are roughly comparable demographically, although charters enroll a larger proportion of African-American students. And while the authors find no evidence that charters provide a better education for particular student groups, this year's study from Stanford Center for Research on Education Outcomes suggests that students in poverty, especially poor African-American students and English language learners, may enjoy more learning gains in charter schools. There is no better spokesperson for the bedrock beliefs of market-based educational reformers than Joe Klein, the former New York City school chancellor, and public education, quote, is, this is according to him, and he's one of the Bill Gates wannabes, quote, public education is essentially a government-run monopoly, he wrote in The Atlantic, stating concisely the position of today's market-oriented reformers. Quote, this is from Joe Klein, whether a school does well or poorly, it will get the students it needs to stay in business because most kids have no other choice. And that in turn creates no incentive for better performance, greater efficiency, or more innovation, all things as necessary in public education as they are in any other field. End quote. Okay. But Lebenskys maintain that we are living in an era in which the allure of market is irresistible. It doesn't matter what the problem is. The solution is always free markets. Consequently, we tend to compare the private sector with the public sector in Manichean terms. Where the private sector is lean, the public sector is bloated. Where the private sector is nimble, the public sector is slow. Over the last several decades, we have turned to the private sector to fulfill a wide range of public services, from correction institutions, national security, transportation, and firefighting. So it should not be surprising that recent school reform measures have been dominated by market-based strategies, such as vouchers, charter schools, and merit pay for teachers. The three pillars of the market strategy, according to this couple, are choice, competition, and autonomy. The theory behind all this is that when you give parents a say in deciding where to send their children to school, they will choose a school of the highest academic caliber. Parents are rational consumers who will make informed decisions about the quality of different educational products, that is, in schools. If parents are not satisfied with a particular school, they will send their child to a different one. But, and here's the rub, parents, Lubinsky's report, seldom make school choice decision based solely on academic considerations. Parents frequently rely upon factors that have no bearing on academic quality, including a school's proximity, its racial composition, and religious orientation, and even whether it has a uniform policy. Market theory predicts that underperforming schools will close due to a lack of demand, but a school's popularity turns out to be a poor proxy for its academic success. Consider the hundreds of failing charter schools across the country that remain open and well attended. With respect to competition, the idea is to unleash the natural powers of the marketplace, spurring schools on to greater effectiveness. I suspect that for most Americans, this is an appealing and sensible proposition. Alas, The authors contend competition among schools does not typically lead to serious and sustained efforts to improve core educational functions. Rather, the data show that schools in competition environments tend to invest more resources in screening out lower-performing students whose subpar test scores would damage the school's academic reputation. Or they spend more money on marketing in order to keep their enrollment numbers up. Neither of these two common responses to market pressure is desirable for a public institution devoted to universal access and common good. Consider the competitive marketplace for for-profit higher education. The former director of the University of Phoenix reported that for-profit colleges tend to spend approximately a quarter of their revenue on sales and marketing while dedicating only 10% to faculty salaries. Do we really want K-10 public education to follow that model? So then it goes on to talk about, hey, you may have an old school building, and you may have a group of kids who don't come from economically upper mobile parents, may not have uniforms, but inside the classroom, the kids are learning. And in point of fact, based upon all the criteria they could find, the kids are learning just as well or even better than those in the private and the charter schools. So once again, you look for the facts, and the facts teach a different story. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to hear from a report from E.O. Wilson. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. Hope you've had a nice holiday. And we're going to be looking for some volunteers because after 20 years in our current office, we're moving to a nicer location and better accommodation for all that we're doing. And we got a lot of packing to do. We're also donating a large amount of equipment to our sister station, WBAI, to help with their needs and so anyone who would like to spend a little time helping wrap stuff and move stuff, call 646-926-5422. 646-926-5422. Now, I want to share with you another input, and then we're going to do TalkBack at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. This is Pillaging the World, the History and Politics of the International Monetary Fund, by Ernst Wolf, Global Research. And again, I'm not going to give all of it. It's a long report, but it's an important one because the average person has no knowledge of the International Monetary Fund. That's dangerous. They're one of the most powerful organizations on Earth. We should know about them, what they do that is right, what they do that is wrong. And no other financial organization that I'm aware of has affected the lives of the majority of the world's population more profoundly over the last 50 years than the International Monetary Fund, or the IMF. And since its inception after World War II, it's expanded its sphere of influence to the remotest corners of the earth. Its membership currently includes 188 countries on five continents. Now, for decades, the International Monetary Fund has been active mainly in Africa, Asia, and South America. There is hardly a country on these continents where its policies have not been carried out in close cooperation with national governments. And when the global financial crisis broke in 2007, the International Monetary Fund turned its attention to Northern Europe. Since the onset of the euro crisis in 2009, its primary focus has shifted to Southern Europe. Now, officially, The IMF's main task consists of stabilizing the global financial system and helping out troubled countries in times of crisis. Wrong. That's nonsense. Reality. The entirety of the International Monetary Fund's ideology is reminiscent to warring armies. Wherever it intervenes, it undermines the sovereignty of states by forcing them to implement measures that are rejected by the majority of the population. Hence, they leave behind a broad trail of economic and social devastation. So in pursuing its objectives, the IMF never resorts to the use of weapons or soldiers. It simply applies the mechanisms of capitalism, specifically those of credit. Its strategy is as simple as it is effective. When a country runs into difficult financial times, the IMF steps in and provides support in the form of loans. In return, it demands the enforcement of measures that serve to ensure the country's solvency in order to enable it to repay those loans. And because of its global status as lender of last resort, governments usually have no choice but to accept the IMF's offer and submit to its terms, thus getting caught in a web of debt, which they, as a result of interest, compound interest and principal, get deeper and deeper entangled in. You start off with a $100 million loan. It ends up being $400 million. The resulting strain on the state budget and the domestic economy inevitably leads to a deterioration of their financial situation, which the IMF in turn uses as a pretext for demanding ever greater concessions in the form of austerity programs. Now, if you want to know how this works, right now, as I'm speaking, go to Greece, go to Spain, go to Italy. Are you aware that there are millions of people protesting in Italy and in Greece and Spain because they've been told, we're not going to cause the banks to fail, even though they caused the problems and exploited the situation. We're not going to demand the proper taxation of those who are the wealthiest, who've evaded taxes, especially in Greece. Instead, we're going to take your pension, and where you were supposed to be able to retire 55, now it's 60. And if you were making $1,200 a month in Greece as a retired 30-year school teacher, we're going to bring it down to $700. And so everywhere you look, they're taking the people's savings. Why? This is the austerity. Will they change anything? They'll change none of their bureaucracy, their corruption, none of the things they have historically done that's gotten them into trouble. None of that changes. Squeezing the public, where you have as high as a 45 to 47% unemployment rate in young people, that they do. So the consequences are disastrous for the ordinary people of the countries affected, which are mostly middle income or lower income, because their governments all follow the same pattern, passing effects of austerity on to wage earners and the poor. But also, it's far more pernicious. The International Monetary Fund programs have cost millions of people their jobs, denied them access to adequate health care. Functional educational systems are gutted. Decent housing is blown away. They have rendered their food unaffordable, increasing homelessness, robbed old people of the fruits of their lifelong work, favored the spread of diseases, reduced life expectancy, and increased infant mortality. You would think that with all that they have done that has been so nefarious that someone in an official position somewhere would call them out. It never happens. Everyone is aware that the wrong word said towards a powerful organization or institution or individual has consequences. It's called blowback. So if you don't want to end up under the microscope, especially now where they can blackmail you, they can hurt you, they can destroy your business, they can destroy your reputation, then you stay silent. At the end of the social scale, however, the policies of the International Monetary Fund, the most corrupt organization in the world, have helped a tiny layer of ultra-rich increase their vast fortunes, even in times of crisis. It measures to the fact that global inequality has assumed historically unprecedented levels. The income difference between a sun king and a beggar at the end of the Middle Ages pales compared to the difference between a hedge fund manager and a social welfare recipient of today. And although these facts are universally known and hundreds of thousands have protested the effects of its measures in the past decades, often risking their lives, the IMF tenaciously clings on to its strategy. Despite all of its criticism, despite the striking, terminal consequences of its actions, it still enjoys the unconditional support of all the governments and all the leading industrial nations. Why? How can it be that an organization that causes such immense human suffering around the globe continues to act with impunity and with the backing of the most powerful forces of our time? In whose interest does the IMF work? Who benefits from his actions? Well, while the Second World War was still raging in Europe, in July 1944, the U.S. invited delegations from 44 countries to the small ski resort known as Brenton Woods, New Hampshire. The official aim of the conference, held for 3 weeks in the luxurious Mount Washington Hotel, was to define the basic features of an economic order for the post-war world, to provide the cornerstones of a system that would stabilize the world economy and prevent a return to the situation that had existed between the two world wars. The 1930s in particular were distinguished by high inflation, trade barriers, strongly fluctuating exchange rates, gold shortages, and a decline in economic activity by more than 60%. Furthermore, social tensions had constantly threatened to break down the established order. The conference had been preceded by several years of secret negotiations between the White House and Downing Street, which had already been working on plans for a new world monetary order since 1940. A recorded comment from the head of the British delegation, the economist Lord Keynes, sheds light on the former elite's attitude towards the interests and concerns of the smaller countries. Quote, this is what he said, 21 countries have been invited which clearly have nothing to contribute and will merely encumber the ground, the most monstrous monkey house assembled for years, end quote. It did not take long before their contemptuous attitude rebounded on Lord Keynes and his compatriots. During the course of the conference, it became increasingly clear how much the global balance of power had shifted to the disadvantage of Great Britain. Excessive war spending had turned the country, already seriously weakened by the First World War, into the world's biggest debtor and pushed it to the brink of insolvency. Great Britain's economy was on its knees, and the rise of the liberation movements around the world already heralded the final breakup of its once global colony empire. The undisputed victor of the Second World War, however, was the United States. Having become the largest international creditor, it held nearly two-thirds of the world's gold reserves and commanded half of all global industrial production. In contrast to most European countries, its infrastructure was intact, and while its delegations engaged in negotiations at Brenton Woods, the U.S. Army General's staff planned a nuclear assault on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in order to emphasize America's claim to global domination. As a result of this new balance of power, Lord Keynes' plan for a new economic order was flat rejected. Representing a country with substantial balance of payments problems, he had proposed an international payments union that would have given countries suffering from a negative balance of payments easier access to loans and introduce an international accounting unit called Bancor, which would have served as a reserve currency. The U.S., however, was unwilling to take on the role of a major creditor that Keynes' plan had foreseen it for. The leader of their delegation, economist Harry Dexter White, in turn presented his own plan that was finally adopted by the conference. This White plan conceptualized a world currency system never before seen in the history of money. The U.S. dollar was to constitute its sole center and was to be pegged to all other currencies at the fixed exchange rate, while its exchange was relegated to gold and was to be set at $35 an ounce of fine gold. The plan was supplemented by U.S. demands for the establishment of several international organizations designed to monitor the new system and stabilize it by granting loans to countries facing balance of payments problems. After all, Washington, due to its size and rapid economic growth, had to come to the fore. They had to lead in all things. We had the raw materials. We wanted to create a global sales opportunity for our overproduction. This required replacing the hitherto most widely used currency, the British pound, by the dollar. Also, time seemed right for replacing the City of London by Wall Street, thus establishing the U.S. as its new position as the focal point for international trade and global finance. The gold-dollar peg and the establishment of fixed exchange rates partially reintroduced the gold standard, which had existed between 1870 and the outbreak of World War I. But the U.S. was to be the dominant figure, and this is how the International Monetary Fund came into being. Now, let me just summarize, because we're running out of time. Here's how it works. Let's say that you are a country that has had corruption in South America, Asia, Africa, and you go to the International Monetary Fund and you say, look, we need $50 billion. And they say, okay, we'll give you $50 billion, but here's what we want. We want a structural austerity measure. It's called structural adjustment. We'll give you this money, but we want to make sure that now your electricity is no longer given by the government. We privatize it. Your water will be privatized. Every road that anyone drives on or walks on, they'll pay a fee, a toll. Your port will be our ports, and we're going to exploit for gold, silver, oil, whatever metal we want. We will not be having to report to anyone. We'll need no permits. We'll need nothing. And the person in charge may want to say no, but in all likelihood, they're corrupt. They'll say yes. They'll get a certain percentage of all the money that comes in. They'll get a percentage of all the private contracts. They'll have family members and friends that will get exclusive and no-bid competition. We saw this in Afghanistan with Karzai, corrupt family. Everyone he's associated with is corrupt. Billions of dollars wasted. And that's how it works. The trouble is the poor person in the country has to be charged higher taxes, and everything they had taken as a given in the past, now they have to pay for. And that's how the International Monetary Fund works. And once you're in their grasp, you don't get out of it. Just imagine the worst of the worst of Tony Soprano's bill collectors. That's the International Monetary Fund. It's an organization that should not exist. It's completely, totally corrupt. I'm Gary Nall. Your opportunity to call in on TalkBack, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Let's say hello to Marco from Long Island. Marco, your turn.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good.
Well, the reason that I'm calling is to add a little bit about what you said about the International Monetary Fund.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
During the crisis in Argentina, they also asked for austerity measures. In this way, they can get payback. And at that time, 35 children were dying every day from desnutrition because they asked you to cut down in the social service, the breakfast for the children, and all the medical service. And this is another reason why Joseph Stiglitz was trying to change how the bank was acting, and he was fired for that reason. That's what I want to
add. You are correct in that. I've been I could go through all the countries I've been to, from Trinidad to Jamaica, who had similar experiences. Once the loans came in, the policies on the ground changed. In the case of Jamaica, the Jamaicans have an enormous amount of fertile soil where they had historically grown. Even if they were low in the way of money, they had other forms of currency, including barter and fair exchange, and where they would reap the abundance of all that nature provided them. And then in came through Bill Clinton, and in came through the loans and potatoes and yams and foods that historically they had grown themselves cheaper than what they could make them. So if you were the average Jamaican and you could buy a pound of potatoes through the United States by the American farmer in Idaho growing them for 20 cents a pound, but the locally grown organically ones were 40 cents a pound. They were not subsidized. You'd buy the 20 cent one. And it destroyed agriculture in Jamaica and caused economic devastation. You are
correct.
Yeah,
that's what happened in Mexico. The 2 million farmers went to bankruptcy because the subsidized corn, they devastated like 10 million people. And they say, well, you saw the influx of Mexicans in these past few years.
You're absolutely correct on that. So I thank you very much for calling in, Marco, from Long Island.
All right.
Charlie.
Have a nice day.
Bye. And we're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.